Hey everyone, you're listening to the Learn Swift podcast. I'm your host, Steve. And on today's show, I've got Isaac Halverson. He is an iOS developer at C.H. Robinson. He previously worked as a web developer there and had the opportunity to switch over to iOS. And he's been doing that for about the last 10 months. Isaac, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So what have you got going on today? It's Saturday.
Today, not much. Just chilling at home, waiting for the show to start.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's I try to make sure all the stars align whenever I have something scheduled. But today, my wife had to go to an appointment today, and I had to move some. I actually had to have somebody else reschedule. I had one scheduled at 11, and then my wife had gotten an appointment to go to the optometrist, and so I had to get back to him, and I was like, "Hey, sorry, my wife has this last minute appointment. Can we reschedule?" And then like it took a while for her to get back, so it was like I had to rush around and set everything up. So go ahead and let everyone know your background, because you were initially a web developer there at C.H. Robinson. So how did you go from, let's just say, how did you even get into web development, and then what made you want to transition over to iOS?
Sure. So I actually just recently got into development in general. I'd been doing IT tech support for about 4 years. I was a genius at an Apple store for a while and then did tech support at an ad agency. But about a year and a half ago, I decided I wanted to take up programming. It's something I'd wanted to do for a really long time. And I found out about a coding boot camp here in the Twin Cities. And it's called Prime Academy. And I just took the leap and attended school there. It was a 3-month program in JavaScript. So we learned front-end JavaScript development and Node.js back-end stuff. And shortly after finishing that, I got a job at C.H. Robinson as a web developer. I was doing that for about, it was about 3 or 4 months doing that, and a entry-level iOS development position opened up. And iOS development is something I ultimately wanted to do. I've wanted to do that since the iPhone came out. But I never thought I'd have an opportunity to get paid doing it this early on. So I jumped at the chance and they put me on that team, and I've been doing that ever since.
That's awesome. So you got how long? So you went to a web development boot camp. Did you get hired by C.H. Robinson like right out of that? Like how long was that? How long was that that period between graduating the boot camp and getting that job at C.H. Robinson?
Yeah, I graduated in January of 2017, and then I did a contract gig for a little while. But in April of that year, so about 3 months, I got hired at C.H. Robinson.
Oh, that's not you know, I've heard about some people going to boot camps and having a really hard time. I mean, 3 months is a long, like feels like a long time, but that's not really all. Like whenever I got my business degree, it took me about 3 months to find a job after I got that, going from like what I was doing previously to somebody that would actually hire me for having that business degree. So sure. that's not that unreasonable. So that's pretty cool. I've heard some other stories. Maybe it depends on the boot camp. Maybe it depends on. Oh, also, just so people know what C.H. Robinson is, see, just because a lot of people around, you know, that listen to the show probably aren't familiar with logistics. Yeah. C.H. Robinson's a trucking company, and I think they also do third party logistics type stuff, right?
Yeah, their main bread and butter is third party logistics. They're actually the largest third party logistics company in the world.
Yeah. Me being in manufacturing and supply chain, I'm familiar with C.H. Robinson. So I figured we should tell everybody what the company does before we.
You're probably the first person that knows what the company is.
So are you handling the application that you work on, is that something internal? Is that something for C.H. Robinson, like enterprise customers, or is it something public facing on the app, like on the app store that anybody can download?
Sure. I'm working on two apps. We have one called Navisphere Carrier and one called Navisphere Driver. And the Carrier app is for like truck dispatchers and carrier companies that ship loads for C.H. Robinson. Excuse me. And then Navisphere Driver is for the truck drivers.
So is that for them to get hooked up with loads whenever they when something becomes available, or is it for like navigation and stuff?
The carrier one, it shows like a map view of available loads that they could like request to ship, and they can look through their past loads and see any drivers that are with their carrier company. And then the driver app is really simple. It's mainly just to track the GPS location of the driver so that customers and carriers can see where their shipments are. And that's the one I've worked on mainly so far. It got released just before I started doing iOS development for the company.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. These are all only available to the people that are actually doing that. So I don't know that usually you don't hear about people talking about that kind of development. So do you know, what are the kind of differences? Cause I feel like, with something that's more like very direct facing to like the people, like the drivers are going to be using, you know, their application, and then, you know, probably customers on the other one. But it's a very specific subset of customers that are already working with C.H. Robinson.
Yeah.
Versus trying to get them to come in. This is more or less like, hey, you're our customer. Here's this app. It would be a great way for you to be able to utilize our services. What is, like, do you guys do user acceptance testing? Like, I feel like this is probably a much more refined process since you have an already existing customer base and you're not trying to bring people in with this app. You've already got them and you're just trying to get them to use it.
Yeah, I mean, some parts are easy, some parts are not. I'm not super involved in that part of it, but I do know a little bit about what goes on. Traditionally, the way the business works is the carriers or the drivers will contact C.H. Robinson reps via phone. They'll just call them and say, I'm going from Austin, Texas to, you know, Maryland. Do you have any loads that I could pick up? And the app just kind of allows that process to be automated. And kind of our big goal is to try to automate as much as we can to save the company money and save the carriers and the truck drivers time. So all of the customers are existing customers, and the reps will usually say like, hey, you know, we have this app. If you'd like to try to use the app and not necessarily have to call us all the time, we can get you set up with that. And there is like a separate onboarding process for the application. If the company already has an account with C.H. Robinson, we have to still onboard them and get them account with the apps. But as far as user testing for the carrier app, we do do quite a bit of that. The carriers are, like the dispatchers, are usually pretty keen on helping us develop the apps and make them better. The driver app has been more difficult. It seems like truck drivers, you know, they're on the road all the time, and they're just kind of trying to get from point A to point B. And it's really hard for us to get in contact with them directly. We did go to a truck stop once and chat with some drivers for like a day. And that was useful and interesting, but it's a lot harder to get a hold of them.
Yeah, that's understandable. That's pretty cool, though. It's almost like Uber for your... I hate to make an analogy like that, but it's almost like Uber for your pickups. It's like, hey, there's a load available here. Anybody that wants to pick it up can come get it.
Well, Uber does have
take it on its way.
Uber does have a freight service now, Uber Freight.
Do they?
Yeah, and I don't really know how well they're doing, but they're definitely a company we keep our eyes on.
Yeah, and you know, Uber's not very well known for being responsible socially or any other way. So I don't know. If I was the logistics manager making the decision on what freight company to use, I don't think Uber would be on the top of my list. But that's just a personal decision.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, that's good.
Yeah. So What kind of experience did you have coming into, especially going from, let me back up there a second. Did you have any iOS experience on the side before you jumped into this role?
Almost none. Probably a couple years ago, I dabbled with it before I even learned web development. And that was trying to learn Objective-C. And I didn't make it very far doing it on my own through books. So basically zero experience with iOS development. But it was surprisingly easy to learn the general concepts. I mean, you know, they always say you learn one programming language and the rest of them come a lot more easily. JavaScript is definitely different than Swift, but I had learned C# while I was at C.H. Robinson as well. And that's, I like to think that Swift is kind of in a middle ground between JavaScript and C#. So it was a pretty easy transition there.
Yeah, you'll find a lot of similarities between, like, you know, everyone that I've talked to that's had experience in another language will always, like, they'll always say, like, oh yeah, this is like it is in like Python, or this is like it is in and whatever other programming language, which is pretty cool. I know that I even found that, like, I had dabbled in Java. I was doing it at the same time. And I was learning Swift and Java at the same time when I first started learning how to program, because I was interested in doing Android as well. And I've dabbled in Android a bit, but I definitely make my primary focus iOS. Sure. But whenever some of the resources on learning like object-oriented programming in general that weren't so great with Swift, because a lot of people are pushing like protocol-oriented programming and stuff like that. But when you're dealing with like Cocoa, you know, that's all object oriented design. And mm-hmm. when you have a lot of people pushing these newer design patterns and ways of thinking in programming, they're also kind of like almost, I don't want to say ignoring, but it's not as much attention is given to OOP. So when I was learning Java, I learned more about object-oriented programming with Java than I did with Swift. And I was actually able to combine, like, you know, the general concepts from Java in both, you know, because when I first came across interfaces in Java, which are like protocols in Swift, I didn't really get interfaces, but I got protocols. And then I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah, I had a similar experience learning C#. I feel like I learned a lot of that foundational object-oriented stuff, interfaces, and was really hard for me to understand at first, but I was grateful to have some of that knowledge going into Swift. I didn't have to relearn all of that stuff. I could just learn the specifics of Swift.
I'm pleased to announce that back sponsoring the show is Lambda School. Lambda School is an online code school that trains students in various software engineering disciplines at no upfront cost to the student. Instead of paying tuition, students enter an agreement to pay Lambda School a percentage of their income for 2 years, and only if their income is over $50,000 a year. In the event a student is unable to find a job after graduating, Lambda School never collects a penny. This incentivizes Lambda School to make sure you have the skills needed to land a high-paying job. Lambda School's instructors have trained hundreds of iOS engineers and worked on iOS development curriculum directly for Apple. Lambda School is offering a free 2-week iOS 101 course with absolutely no strings attached. There are two cohorts available starting June 11th and June 25th, operating on a Monday through Thursday schedule. Each day covers 1 hour of live instruction, an hour of practice problems with TAs available to answer any questions, and another hour of small group discussion around the problems. The cohort covers an introduction to Swift, the basics of Xcode and UIKit, and is a perfect way to see if Lambda School is the right fit for you. Listeners of the Learn Swift podcast can sign up for the free 2-week course at lambdaschool.com/learnswift. Thanks to Lambda School for sponsoring the show. So what was it like getting into the code base initially? So you, like, especially coming, like, for one, you had little to no Swift experience, and then now you're a junior iOS developer in a Swift code base.
Yeah, I kind of got thrown to the wolves. I don't think I mentioned I when I joined the mobile team, it was because the current iOS developer was moving to a different position in the company. He was going to be doing some more API related stuff. So I joined as a junior iOS developer, and I was the only iOS developer in the company, really. So I kind of just had to figure everything out on my own. The code base was very complicated. It still is very complicated. And it was written, both of the apps were written by people who, like, it was their first app, their first iOS app as well. So,
oh, wow.
I'm sure, like, you know, you look back at code you wrote even a year ago and you're like, oh man, that's ridiculous. I could do it way better now. So it wasn't the best put together project, but it's good and bad. I mean, I had to learn fast, I learned very quickly, like, the right ways to do things and the not best way to do things just by seeing a complex code base.
And all the wrong ways how to do it. And not to say that it works, but, like, they always say the best way is to learn by doing. And if you have to do it, like, I think that's one of the more difficult parts of being, like, you know, a self-taught developer, is that you pick and choose your problems. Whereas in your case, you didn't get to pick and choose your problems. They're like, here it is. This is your job now. Go for it. Make it work.
Thankfully, I do have, like, I have guidance from the business. I mean, our mobile team is me, the iOS developer. We have one Android developer who's also a junior. And then we have a, like, mobile team lead who used to be the Android developer. And he's got a lot of experience in just programming in general, and has a good amount of experience with mobile development in general, having done Android. So he was able to provide a lot of guidance to me in general, like, here's how we would do it on Android. And then I could kind of translate some of that to iOS. And, you know, if I ran into a problem, he could help me in general terms. So I still had guidance and help, but there is, you know, a lot of specifics to iOS that aren't the same on Android or web or really any other platform that I had to learn on my own.
Yeah, they are two very different beasts. Like, what?
Yeah.
On your the only similarities that you'll really, really come across between the two platforms is in your business logic, really. And that's about it, because once you start getting into, like, the God, Android is I have a much healthier respect for iOS after dealing with the stuff that Android developers deal with on a daily basis.
Sure.
Have you seen what the activity lifecycle on Android is like?
No.
Oh my God. Okay. So imagine that for every, and this is the Learn Swift podcast, but I want everybody to understand how good we have it. In my experience in Android, the amount of boilerplate code, like, people complain about, like, iOS and Swift boilerplate stuff, it is, like, beyond, like, anything that you'll in Android. It's like two or three times worse. Like, to set up essentially the equivalent of a table view, you pretty much need, like, it'll take, like, double or triple the amount of code to just set up all the boilerplate for that. There might be better ways to do it. I've been doing it all manually, but, like, granted, we're not using any third-party libraries or any, like, fancy tricks to make a table view work. We're just having a table view. We're setting up, like, the data source and then, like, the delegate methods, essentially, for what happens. In Android, it's like you have to make two different classes or two different subclasses and do some other stuff. And then every time the phone is rotated in Android, the entire view hierarchy, the current screen and what the equivalent of a view controller is completely destroyed and redrawn to the screen. You lose all of your state on rotation. Wow. So you have to, yeah. So you have to add boilerplate to persist that state in something called that they call the view lifecycle method is on saved instance state. And then it's they have this data type called a bundle where you can put your stuff into this bundle and then make it come back out. It only takes like your primitive types plus a handful of Android types. So all of your classes, if you want them to go directly into one of these bundles, you have to add conformance to a parcelable protocol or interface rather in Java or Kotlin. You have to add conformance to that. And then you have to tell it how to pack it up and how to unpack it. So that's just more. Whereas like in iOS, you just like if you're going from one view controller to first of all, you don't have to worry about rotating your device. It's just still there. It doesn't get destroyed. And maybe that happens behind the scenes, but iOS at least takes care of that state. It doesn't make us deal with it. And then it's a nightmare.
And there's I've actually kind of enjoyed working alongside these Android developers because I hear about a lot of this stuff that you're mentioning, like a lot of the low level stuff that iOS takes care of for you. They have to manage themselves on Android, but there are some benefits. I mean, because there's all this boilerplate and structural stuff that has to happen before you really even start writing the app, there's a lot. It seems like there's a lot more open source libraries, really well-written open source libraries that the community is writing and a part of than on iOS. They're always talking about their dependency injection frameworks and networking libraries, and we definitely have those on iOS, but it just doesn't seem like they are quite as actively developed or there's quite a community around them because some of that stuff you can get around. You don't have to think a lot about it. If there is an error on iOS, sometimes it's just kind of, you know, shuffled under the carpet and, you know, that didn't happen. You don't have to worry about it. Whereas on Android, if something happens, it just kind of crashes. So you know when there's a problem and you know that you have to fix something, which, you know, there's benefits and drawbacks to both sides, I think.
Yeah, you know, I will say that is one of the nice things about like having being able to pull in third party dependencies right without having to add another dependency. Essentially, like so, CocoaPods is cool. So is Carthage. That's great. But it, you know, Android Studio uses Gradle, and you can just essentially put in whatever dependency that you want, and it'll just fetch it for you. You don't have to create like. You're forced to use an XC workspace with CocoaPods. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want that, you have to use Carthage. And, you know, it's that I will say that is nice. And like I recently built a library for optical character recognition that Android or Google actually maintains one for use in Android projects. You just bring it in. It's free. It doesn't cost any money. I think it's pretty sure it's based on the same thing that I built on top of for iOS. But yeah, you just drop it in. It does the same stuff mine does, except it's maintained by Google. For their Android
projects. It's really cool that Google is very open source in supporting these like extra libraries. And it wasn't that way with iOS for a while, but Apple's starting to do a lot more open source stuff. I mean, obviously Swift itself is open source and it's pretty exciting. I'm a really big open source proponent. So it's exciting to see that happening more and more on the iOS side.
Well, and you know, it seems like where Android will make like what's essentially I don't even want to call it a third party library, but they'll make a library that you can bring in through a Gradle build.
Sure.
Whereas like in iOS, it just like instead of like adding another build step, like with like the Vision framework, right? When there's something new, you just go import Vision or whatever.
Sure.
Instead of it making it an open source thing, which is, you know, neither here nor there really. But yeah, there's trade-offs for sure.
Yeah. I'm definitely glad I'm doing iOS stuff, but some of the Android stuff is cool too.
Yeah, they've got some pretty cool libraries on there. So What kind of third party libraries do you use in your code base? If you can share that, I'm not sure if you're.
Yeah, I don't think there's a problem.
Silence on that kind of detail.
Let's see. Right now, I'm trying to think. We use Realm on the Carrier app for some of the map related stuff, storing locations of loads and displaying them like grouped on the map. We use Alamo Fire for our network requests, although I'm hoping to lose that dependency if possible. I'd like to move towards just using URL session. And then we use SwiftyJSON, and that's another one I'd like to lose that dependency at some point to start using Codable.
Are you guys still on Swift 3 in that code base?
We're using Swift 4 as of last week now. We were using Swift 4 on Driver for a while, but we just moved Carrier to Swift 4 last week. So,
okay. So, have you messed with Core Data at all? Because I've been interested in Realm. I still haven't dabbled in it. I bought that Ray Winderlich book a part of when they had that that sale for their. I don't know if you saw that, the sale that they had for the Advanced Swift Pack or something. It's got the algorithms, the design patterns, and then the Realm book.
Sure.
I haven't messed with that yet. The Realm one. How do you like? Have you messed with Core Data, and what do you think of it, like, versus Realm?
I haven't messed with it a ton. I haven't messed with Core Data at all, and I haven't interacted with Realm a lot yet because that's we're using that in the Navisphere Carrier app, which I haven't interacted with as much. The little bit that I have, though, it seems nice that it abstracts a lot of the technical things for you, extracts them away. I've heard Core Data can be difficult to work with, but I haven't messed with much persistence on iOS.
Yeah, there can be some gotchas with Core Data. But I think it's one of those things, like, if you just go into it trying to put as little effort into it as possible, that's probably where you're going to get burned. Mm-hmm. With Core Data. If you just really, like, whenever you're doing, like, especially if you're like making new contexts, essentially, like, as a first scratch pad, like, so that you don't make changes to your underlying persistence store. And then if you don't handle those changes, like, that you're wanting to save, like, you know, that can be an issue, or doing anything multi-threaded can be, there can be gotchas there. But other than that, I mean, I've had pretty good experience with Core Data in general.
Do you have to use Core Data if you plan to sync over iCloud?
Yeah, I don't know that you have to. I think it may be easier, but I'd actually heard of some that iCloud sync wasn't really as easy as just, you know, just saying, oh, sync this Core Data, you know, sync this core data instance or whatever database to iCloud, and it's, you know, it's not as simple as, like, call, like, iCloud services dot sync with dot managed object content, or, you know, it's not as simple as that. I remember actually hearing a lot of I'm pretty sure that you could probably implement that however you want, really, because it ends up, have you messed with iCloud at all for using it as a database for users?
No, not yet. I have a little side project I'm working on that I plan to, but I haven't dug into that yet.
So, okay, yeah. So it's been a while since I have. It kind of reminds me of, have you ever messed with Firebase?
Yeah.
Okay, so kind of how you structure the data on, like, Firebase and, like, the real-time database. Okay. It's kind of the same way on there. And I'm pretty sure the interactions with it, like, you know, obviously it's a completely different framework. But the you know, the idea is the same. It's not, like, coupled directly to Core Data. So you could probably implement syncing however you wanted to. doing it their way might just be easier, but you know, I can't vouch for that. I haven't done any syncing with iCloud personally. Okay. Do you do any type of code review at your job?
That's a good question. Our mobile team lead does review my code, and he actually does a pretty good job, especially for not having any experience with Swift. All of my pull requests, we use GitHub, like an enterprise GitHub at work. So all of my pull requests get approved by him. But we are actually getting a new iOS developer next week, a senior iOS developer. So hopefully I will get some more like iOS specific code review knowledge soon.
Yeah, one of the things that I've always wanted, I've never experienced a real code review. I've never had anybody look at my code and suggest like, oh, maybe you could, you know, I just have to almost assume that I'm doing like, I end up reviewing my own code. I'll take a look at it and be like, is this how I really want to do it? But at the end of the day, like, you know, having somebody like look at your stuff from with a fresh set of eyes. Mm-hmm. Too, because it's not even necessarily that they have to be experienced in your particular area necessarily, just that they can at least read it and like make suggestions and be like, oh well, why did you do all this when this could be done with just like, you know, an if statement versus like, you know, who knows, I'm just something arbitrary. But
yeah, sure. Well, now that you've got those two open source libraries, maybe you'll be able to get some other people to contribute or give you suggestions.
Yeah, you know, I have gotten a few issues made on those projects. Cool. One person, yeah, it was pretty cool. My first bug was, or my first GitHub issue was for it being multi-threaded. Or being thread safe rather, for the underlying the base project Swiftie Tesseract, and because if you accessed it from multiple threads, you would have the classic readers writers problem. I don't know, but essentially like where one thread is reading essentially, and then while another one's writing, so it changes everything underneath it. You know, just classic shared mutable state problem. Okay. So I took, yeah, I was able, so I fixed that, because the library itself, like the underlying library, isn't thread safe. So I had to essentially make my own, I essentially had to make it thread safe from my level.
Okay. And then someone submitted that as an issue then?
Actually, say that again.
Someone submitted that as an issue. Did they like give you a suggestion? Like, here's a way you could fix it. Or did they just tell you there's a problem?
Nobody's submitted like a pull request or anything yet. They've only had issues. Let me see. I haven't checked. It hasn't had a whole lot of movement. I've only got like 2 stars on my product. One of them's me. Let's see. CocoaPods will tell me how many. Now, the unfortunate thing about CocoaPods, so like I implemented, CocoaPod search has not been working. Have you? I don't know if you've.
Yeah, I just noticed that the other day. I haven't been able to search on there either.
Yeah, so I know my pod's website URL on there, mm-hmm. But let's see. The unfortunate part is like the downloads isn't really that great of a metric for it. So I've had like. It says like I've had 74 downloads, but every time I push to my project, it runs a CI build. So when that CI build runs, it, you know, it builds the, you know, it downloads the, it, so it's not really, it has 8 app installs, 3 apps this last week, okay. And then 1 test target. And then for the other one, let's see, the other one's much less impressive, 3 apps total, 1 app this week with a total of 43 downloads. That is the one that this is the real time engine. It builds on top of the other one.
Okay.
So
very cool. I definitely like, I kind of have a dream to release some sort of open source iOS library. I just have to find a problem no one's solved yet. But I'm it's cool that you're doing that, and especially being relatively new to it.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody did solve the problem, but they didn't continue to solve the problem, which is why I kind of, that's why I started this one. The old one, they had, there was one that already existed, because there's actually a Ray Winderlich article about doing OCR in iOS applications, and they use this one called Tesseract OCR iOS, written in Objective-C and Objective-C++. But the problem with that is they haven't pushed a commit to master since like 2016, like December 2016, and then they haven't actually made a tagged release since 2015. So nobody's getting those unless they go, like, nobody's getting any updates. They haven't, like, and when you put it into your project, there's hundreds of compiler warnings. So I don't even remember what they were at the time, but I just know that whenever I see a triangle and it has three digits in it, I get concerned. So, yeah.
Yeah, our project, the Carrier app, has a lot of warnings as well. It's hard to, like, they're an annoyance, but it's also hard to know if there's a new one and if there's one that you need to worry about. So I definitely get that.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people like to put, well, I don't know about a lot of people, but some people like to make, make the Xcode setting to treat warnings as errors so that it won't compile, if you have any warnings. So if you have a project like that, that, you want to prevent from building, because you introduced an error and you just don't, or a warning and you don't want it to build, whenever you bring in a project like that, you have to unset that, because now your project won't build because this one's got so many.
Okay. I didn't know about that setting. That might be handy.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes me excited. Have you heard about the new, I think the new compiler flags, I think, are coming.
Oh yeah. There's like warning and error in 4.2.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that. I can't wait to use that, because I think that's I put to-dos and marks and stuff like that in my files. Mm-hmm. But it would just be nicer to just like make a warning and say like implement this, or make it error and just say, hey, you need to implement this before you even compile this, because it's just not gonna work as expected. So I'm
kind
of
excited.
Yeah,
it's like a forced to do.
Exactly, yeah. It's hard to miss if you don't have, I guess if you've got like warnings in yours, you could just do it as errors and you'd be able to spot those pretty easy.
Yeah.
Are most of your warnings in your project from third-party libraries?
No, we have like a build step that like converts any to-dos or fix-me's into warnings. So some of it is that.
Oh, okay.
We've got quite a few auto layout things. And I don't think most of the warnings are serious at this point. I mean, the app is running and it's in the App Store and working for lots of people, but it would be nice to clean all those up so I can see if there are actual warnings that are important.
Yeah. 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 That would be nice if you could keep a warning, but like give an elevated warning, like instead of like it being yellow, like, you know, go from yellow to orange, then to red, maybe. Sure. Like, okay, this is an error that I actually want to, or like, it's, you know, like auto layout errors. We'll make those priority like 5.
Right.
Whereas like the one where it's messing up something, or could potentially mess up something, we'll make that a priority 7.
Yeah.
That'll be orange.
Maybe Swift 4.3, we can get that in the spec.
Right. So are there, like, what was one of the, I think we talked about the hurdles, really, of coming into a completely alien code base, having no Swift experience. What would you say was one of your biggest triumphs so far, and, you know, coming from essentially like, okay, this is what Swift is, so how do I read or write this, to, you know, now you're 10 months in and you've been at it for a little bit and probably feel pretty competent thus far.
Yeah. So when I first started, our Navisphere driver app had just recently been recently been released. And the way it worked was, when the drivers were driving a load, they had to open the app and hit a button to like post their location. So it was entirely reliant on the drivers actually opening the app and pressing a button. And shortly thereafter, we implemented a like background process tracking system that would allow the app to continually update location in the background. And that was really, really difficult, managing the background processes and making sure the phone didn't shut us down because the phone obviously has a lot of battery management features, which are great for the user experience. But in our case, we like got permission from the drivers to continue tracking their location as they were shipping this load. So we had to find ways to keep pinging their location in the background. And it took months to figure out how to do that. Background processes aren't easy on iOS. So,
you know,
I would say that's a triumph.
Yeah, that is a triumph. That's pretty awesome. And you know what you describe is like, and at least in this is the only like situation where that is not creepy at all, because
yeah, right.
Because like, yeah, when Charles Proxy was released for iOS, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah.
People were talking about like various apps that they figured out were. But I think it was like a stargazing app, which makes sense. It needs your location to see where you're at. But but that's still kind of creepy to see an app that you haven't opened in a while to still be sending off your location.
Yeah, and part of the challenge with ours too was we wanted to track their location when they were shipping a load, but also stop tracking locations when they weren't shipping a load for us. So we had to build in a lot of checks to see if they were currently driving for C.H. Robinson or driving a specific load, and turn off that location tracking when they weren't.
That's pretty cool. That sounds like an interesting problem to tackle. I bet I would imagine that did you like party hard after you implemented it? Like, that seems like one of those things that like after you've tackled it, you're like, I'm the best.
Yeah, it did feel great. We went out for like a happy hour for the team, because Android implemented the same feature, and it got done at about the same time. So it was a long fought battle, and we were definitely happy to celebrate.
That's awesome. Yeah, yeah. That's one of the best feelings. And I haven't had something that I worked on that long, but you know, a couple weeks, you know, that's about been the longest thing that I've had to fight against. But yeah, it just feels amazing. It just feels amazing. Something that you think that you're never going to get, like this seems impossible.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden something just miraculous happens, and you just think about it in a slightly different way, and
yep,
boom.
Yeah, and like this particular problem I found really hard to, it doesn't seem like a lot of people are doing that or need to do that on iOS, so it was actually really difficult for me to find resources. So I had to do a lot of, you know, strategic Googling and digging through documentation. So I learned a ton. It was frustrating, but a really good learning experience.
It's amazing.
And it's cool that, you know, our apps are unique in the challenges that we're solving. I mean, we're doing this background GPS tracking. We actually just released the driver app in Europe, and we translated it into 10 new languages, and we had to change like the way measurements and time and dates are displayed based on the country and the locale. And we actually had to debug a really crazy networking issue for Europe specifically. So there's a lot of unique challenges that I'm learning about.
So with the was it already internationalized? Like, is that the word for it? I forget. Localized. Was the app already localized for North America?
Yeah, it was. I think when I started, it was in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. I think those were the only three countries.
Okay. Yeah, because I was going to ask what the... I haven't done anything with localization yet, you know, so...
Yeah, hopefully you don't have to. It's a pain.
Yeah, so... well, you guys have the resources for actually hiring people to actually do the translations and the contextual translations, because I've heard that people go to like, some people will go to like Google Translate, but like whatever phrase that they're using isn't necessarily like the context doesn't make sense, even though it's like literally the same thing, but it's not sure. The same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And we have like an entire European division of the company. So a lot of the translations happen just by our employees in Europe.
Oh, wow.
And there's a lot of like specific industry terms that you can't really translate on Google Translate.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Is there anything else that you want to talk about? Because we're starting to run a little low on time, but open to, is there any kind of tips or suggestions that you have for anybody else new to Swift and iOS development, or any cool resources that you want to share?
That's a good question. Well, I think, so being the only iOS developer, I think I definitely lack like community. So I've found a lot of benefit from going to local meetups. There's a couple iOS and Swift specific meetups in town, and it's just really good to like find other people that are interested in what I'm doing. And I've already learned great things from them. And I got the chance to go to this year's RW DevCon. And that was a really great experience. I'd already been learning a lot from Ray Wenderlich's tutorials and such, and I had a couple books from them already. But that was really great to just be in a bunch of really technical discussions with other iOS nerds. I would say go to meetups if they're available. Go to conferences if it's possible for you. I think SwiftFest is coming up. That one sounds really cool, and I'm hoping to be able to go to that one too. So,
yep, I will be there. FYI, they have sponsored the show previously. I've already got episodes in the pipeline. So, by the time that this one airs, it will probably be a lot closer to SwiftFest, I want to say.
Okay.
Let's see. Today's the 12th, so SwiftFest is in 4 weeks, just about. So.
Yeah.
5 weeks.
Yeah, I'm already working with my manager trying to get a chance to go to that one too. So we'll see. I might be able to be there.
Yeah, I'll have you know that I have a 20% discount available.
Oh.
Yeah. It is Learn Swift 20 off. Or Learn Swift podcast. All right. 20 off. Yeah. I don't know. You can see it in the show notes from the episode that they sponsored, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can get, cool. Save your company 20% anyway, if they're gonna be the ones to buy the ticket.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I will definitely pass that along.
Yeah.
One other thing I'd like to mention. I'm working on two apps on the side, just kind of fun side projects, and I've open sourced them both on GitHub. And I'd love for anyone to contribute or even just check out the code or submit issues or pull requests. I'd really love to get involved with some open source stuff, and anyone wants to check them out.
Yeah, we'll drop that in the show notes. You can send that to me over Twitter, or you can drop it in the little chat box here, and I'll cool. I'll put that in the show notes. I would like to remind everyone that the Learn Swift podcast is part of the Swift Coders Network of podcasts. We've got Fireside Swift with Zach and Steve. We've got Swiftcraft with E-Man. And we've got Swift Coders with the famous Garrick. So make sure you check those guys out. Isaac, thanks for coming on the show. And appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, it's been great to be here. If anyone wants to get in touch, I'm on Twitter at H. Isaac.
Oh, yeah, that's just it, right? H. Isaac, yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And anybody, you can anyone, everyone, doesn't matter who you are. You can reach me on Twitter at Steven_0351. And if you want to be on the show, head over to learnswift.fireside.fm.